Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle. This program today is made possible by a generous contribution from Public Utilities Fortnightly and a conference which it is running in Arizona in November, looking at the effect on traditional utilities of disruptive technologies like wind and solar. You can check on it at the Public Utilities Fortnightly website. We have a great show today, and of course I'm joined as always by Linda Gasparello, the co-host of this program. And I'm very glad to have with us Edward Acorn, who is a man I admire enormously. He's the editorial page editor of the Providence Journal. We have a copy of that newspaper here. In case you're nowhere near Rhode Island, there it is. And he is also a distinguished author. Now, one of your books has just gone into paperback, a very readable one because I read it.
That's right. The Summer of Beer and Whiskey is out in paperback.
Fabulous book. Mention it again. It's about this man who owned
it's a baseball book.
Baseball book. But it's not a baseball book. It's about a nutcase who was very successful.
It's about a nutcase who founded the St. Louis Cardinals. So it's a lot of people are having fun reading it.
It's a very, very entertaining book. I really do recommend it. And I'm very glad to have with us Tom Patterson, who is in his own way a genius, in my opinion. He's one of the great sketch artists of this world. He's also an architect with a practice that largely deals with saving old buildings, reconfiguring old buildings, and he has a passion for the historic mills of New England. Welcome to the broadcast, Tom Patterson.
Thank you.
And to make this more interesting, he has some paper there. And as we're talking today, he's going to do some scratches.
And contribute at the same time.
And contribute.
Which shows you how really talented he is.
And then we're going to hold the sketches up. So
right.
If you don't like what he sees, says, you may like what he draws. And if you don't like it at all, blame me.
We will.
Linda Gasparello, you once lived in Iran. You speak Farsi, the Iranian language.
Yeah.
And what do you think of the deal? A very controversial deal in some circles. Great division between in favor of the settlement over nuclear development, the development of weapons in Iran. How does that strike you?
Well, I think a lot of people in the non-proliferation community would like to have seen a modified deal, a deal that you could modify. But you can't do that right now. We probably would all like to see fewer centrifuges, deeper inspections, longer lasting ban on arms sales, but unfortunately that's not going to happen. What we have to look at right now is the deal that we do have and what would be the consequences of scuttling that deal. And one of the consequences, of course, would be that Iran would be betrayed and would probably go into some of the behaviors that we've been trying to prevent. Number two, our European and Asian partners in this would feel very betrayed. Number three,
two of the partners are Russia and China.
And China. Number three, we would have an inability to really deal with Iran in the future because of this betrayal. But there's a really interesting other side of it, of the deal, which I think is worth noting. And we built up a very important financial structure that was there to prevent Iran from doing a lot of things. And this was done through our banks, and it was done through European banks. And it gave us really unprecedented visibility.
This is the sanctions.
That's right. Unprecedented visibility into what was going on. Were terrorists trying to move things into Iran that they shouldn't have moved into Iran? If we scuttle this deal, we may have this kind of action go into another bank that is away from our visibility. For instance, like the new Chinese Asian Investment Bank. We would not be able to surveil what was going on through such a bank.
So the short answer is you're for the deal.
I'm for the deal because I think that this is a deal that's going to buy us a little time. It isn't going to mean that Iran isn't going to develop these
weapons. Look where it is in the world. It's got some pretty lousy neighbors.
Absolutely, Llewellyn. But I think that, that an important aspect of it is this financial structure that basically President Bush built up.
And your newspaper, therefore yourself as the chief editorial writer, took a different view, that you didn't, you did not endorse this deal. You thought it could have been better.
Very disappointed in the deal. We thought it could have been better. We don't have a sense that Iran is going to change its behavior in the world as a supporter of terrorism. We don't think it accomplishes what President Obama hoped to accomplish in 2012 when he said Iran should abandon its nuclear program. It just delays a little bit of this. We're concerned about an embargo on ballistic missiles going away, permitting Iran to move forward with developing weapons that could deliver these, well, missiles that could deliver these weapons to the United States, among other places. We fear it's going to unleash an arms race in the Middle East, especially with Saudi Arabia. And it's troubling. We think, you know, obviously this is extremely difficult. We're dealing with, and we supported these negotiations strongly. It's extremely difficult with all these partners of ours trying to negotiate this, and Iran is an extremely strong negotiator.
Can we go back on this deal?
Sure. Can we go back?
Can we renegotiate it? Will we keep the sanctions in place? Will we get our allies at the table? Or will they say, no, we had a deal, you didn't support your own deal, America walked away from a deal that it negotiated, we're going to trade with Iran?
Yeah.
Or we encourage, allow, and assist an Israeli attack on nuclear facilities, and those have not always been successful. Tom?
I'm just saying that it doesn't really matter how you feel about it, because if a tipping point is reached, and the Israelis perceive that, facility is out of business. Attack that facility.
Well, first of all, they can't get there without material support from us.
That's right.
And the Iranians, this is a very large country, physically a large country. And even if you knock them out, you know, the path to nuclear weapons is well known, and they've gotten very far along it. Some years ago, I testified before the United States Senate on proliferation, and I was very flattered that I was asked. So I looked around and studied it as best I could. I used to write a lot, still do, about nuclear. And I came up with a rather sad view that our position and the position of all the nuclear weapon states to all the non-nuclear weapon states was, trust us because we don't trust you. Well, that's not a very good negotiating base. I have a lot of faith in our negotiators in this time, particularly those in the Department of Energy. People don't always understand that the Department of Energy runs our nuclear weapons and knows about centrifuges and all the ways there are of enriching uranium. And of course, it's a deal that will work, as all deals will, with a certain modicum of goodwill on both sides, or it won't work. But something else will have to be done. The idea that you can go back and renegotiate, I do not think is possible.
No, that's not going to happen. But the thing is that both sides, Llewellyn.
What do you think should happen now, Ed? Linda and I agree more or less about this deal.
You're right. It's very far down the path. I mean, it's difficult to go back and reapply sanctions and try to put some pressure against the Iranians to get a better deal. I suppose the best thing we can hope for is somehow that we can work with the Iranians to somehow bring them into the family of nations and not be quite as much a supporter of terrorism.
There is absolutely. I mean, they've got to stop that soon. Cuba did stop, and was a supporter of terrorism.
We need to remove Iran from outlying nations like North Korea. Iran is an important country. It's important where it is in the Middle East and in the world. And we need to make sure that Iran is in this community of nations where we all actually begin to have an understanding of what is important in this world. Nonproliferation, I think, is very important. I think for us, we need to manage right now the Arab world's I think, impulse now to begin an arms race. I think it's important to...
It's a little harder than they think. I mean, Iran has worked on this, and we got the Iranians going.
Well, of course we did.
With the Arms for Peace, we had our universities chocked full of Iranian students in the 1970s studying nuclear.
That's right.
I mean, good deeds can produce punishments. But let's move on.
Well, Llewellyn, yeah. I have one point, and that is that there could be always a joker in that deck, and that is the influences, whether they're at the surface or underneath, of the more conservative Muslim elements in the country. And they could very well, at some point in the future, just say, it's not our agreement. We'll build on the knowledge that we've constructed, and literally the parts of a whole that have been constructed, and it's very tenuous. I think even now that government is
I think it's tenuous, but you've got something going on in Iran, which Linda and I have both seen on a recent visit to Vietnam, and that is an enormously youthful population. They weren't there for the Shah, they weren't there for the revolution, they like things American, and there are about 90 million Iranians. There may be 150 million in 25, 30 years. And they're not so infused with the religious ideology we hear. Now, there are a lot of good American journalists in Iran, but who knows where something is going to go.
And may I also say...
I'm very negative about what is evolving in the Middle East as far as who has what, as far as weaponry is concerned, because I believe that at any point, one of the very subversive, scary groups like ISIS could easily have access to a weapon.
Now, I would like to say that if you're worried about things and you're worried about who has what weaponry, as it stands right now, the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia way outweigh what Iran has. And if Iran is going to renovate its weaponry, can we not use Iran?
How do you mean outweigh what Iran has? They don't have nuclear weapons.
No, they don't have nuclear weapons.
Do they have ballistic missile capability?
I'm sure, are going to be getting that capability when they renovate some of the things that they have that are in just the conventional side. You change what the arms look like.
Let me suggest this, and then we're going to change the subject. But there is an asymmetry between the skills in Iran and the skills in Saudi. There's an asymmetry between the size of the population in Iran and the size of the population in Saudi. That counts. We don't know. I mean, we don't know. It's a very difficult moment. I have great confidence
in the technical
people on the American side. They're brilliant. I know some of them, and I really have very high opinions.
If you're who has what weaponry right now, the Arabs have much more weaponry than the Iranians have.
Yeah, but
a point. Iranians have more people.
In what? They have no standoff. They have no ships. I mean, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, they have a lot of weapons we've given them, some of which they can use and some of which they're not so good at using. We're seeing for the first time the Saudi Air Force actually in action after all the planes we've sold them. We've got to see how that works out. I'm going to change the subject.
All right.
I'm going to say hello to our viewers, our listeners, that is, on Sirius XM radio and some commercial radio stations that now take the audio feed of this program. You are listening to White House Chronicle. With myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello, who is a Middle East expert and co-producer of this program, my good friend Ed Acorn, very thoughtful, wise editorial page editor of the Providence Journal, one of our better provincial newspapers, and the extraordinary Tom Patterson. The only thing I regret is that listeners on radio will not see his marvelous artwork. He's drawing even while he's talking. And we're going to change the subject. This program can be seen roughly on 200 American television stations and around the world on the stations of Voice of America at the Sirius XM program, where you can be seen four times, or listened to, rather, I should say, four times on the weekends. New subject. subject that titillates, amuses, and somewhat scares. What is happening in the election for the president? And what are your friends in the Republican Party up to, Ed Acorn?
My friends, well, it's silly season, isn't it? It seems to be. Trump yeah, is.
I'm always. Silly seasons tend to turn serious without necessarily all the players changing.
Well, I think Trump's going to be weeded out personally. He's a reality TV star. He knows how to get attention. He knows how to say things that whip up the cable news networks. And
he's a great entertainer,
he
Donald
is.
Trump.
He's a great entertainer.
And he's got a pretty good following. It's really quite small, but it's about 25% of the candidates running.
That's right.
25%, but that's of the 16 candidates running. That's not 25% of the electorate or even of the Republican Party. Be careful. But he has certainly come. It's very interesting that we always get this player who says that in any democracy, I will put my boot to posteriors and everything will be all right.
Right.
And usually it doesn't work. They don't get very far. He, in a sense, has gotten amazingly far. But as he has no single philosophy, I don't think he's going
to
influence
the
debate. Well,
and I was about to make that point. If you had to say what he represents, what the voters, and especially the independent voters, are believing that they're seeing in him, I couldn't name one thing.
Now look, Donald Trump represents Donald Trump, and that is all. And I think
Rick Perry really
nailed it when he said this is Trumpism, this is a new type of politics, this is a kind of below-the-belt politics that I think even the Republican Party should be discouraging.
The name-calling.
And what's interesting about him that is no matter what he says, he wins because he's on TV and he's in the papers, and that's all he cares about. Donald Trump wants to win. Winning is what it's all about.
I think at this point he actually thinks he can be president and that he
would
be
good at it. Well, he said something really pouty. I mean, he said that he would think about forming a third party, depending on how the Republican Party treated him. If he was treated nicely and with respect, well, then he wouldn't do it. But if he was disrespected, then he would do it. I mean, what kind of tantrum politics do we have going on here?
He will wear thin after a while, but I think he does represent something, which is this feeling in America that Washington just doesn't care about us or listen to us and won't even discuss things that we care about, and he's able to throw these bombs.
Okay, now wait a minute.
I think if you just peel back one or two layers and put it before Jane or John Q. Public, I think a lot of people, a lot of independents like myself, are worried about the disparity, as it's called, between the wealthier making more and the working poor making less, and how that gap is growing. What in heaven's name does Donald Trump have to say about that very worrisome subject? I mean, he's one of the 2%. He's the guy causing the problem.
And Washington does care about immigration. We've had a lot of immigration fits and starts up in the Congress and with the president. But you know, when Donald Trump does something like behave like the know-nothings of the 1800s, I mean, this is a group that you can understand. You're writing a book about Lincoln. The know-nothings were anti-immigrant. Mm. They believed that the status quo should be for Native Americans. And he's channeling this. I mean, he's channeling it to the point where Lincoln wrote in 1855, if government is going to be run by know-nothings, I want to emigrate to a place where there is respect for liberty.
Right.
And I think that Trump, knowing it or not, he's a know-nothing.
Well,
but he's a triumphant know-nothing.
And dons are too dangerous. I think he's an entertainer and a fraud, but I think he's tapping into something happening in our culture.
He's tapping into this widespread, as did the Tea Party before him, and as on the left is.
And that's
I don't
know-nothing.
Think you can say the Tea Party and Donald Trump are in any way associated.
People feel that they're not represented, that things go on without, and they have, different people have different ideas of the conspiracy they're against. Some that it's welfare taking all their money,
right.
Some that it's Medicare taking all their money. Not if you're my age, you don't feel that way at all. Different things, but it amounts to the sense that they're not represented, and here is somebody who, prima facie, looks like he may represent them. But The come on strong people fade very fast, right, as did Chris Christie.
I think he'll last about 2 seconds in any kind of debate, because somebody who's a real person, like the governor of Wisconsin, who actually does represent the values of taxpayers and independents like myself, we'll just shoot him right down. I'm sure
certainly not Yunus.
That's true.
Certainly not Yunus.
That's true.
Before we give one candidate, we've got an interesting thing. What do you feel? Do you feel that the party will coalesce around one person?
Oh, I think so. This is sort of early, as I say, the silly season. I don't think Trump's going to establish himself as the party leader.
I don't either, but I do think that it's important to watch all the Republican candidates and see if they adopt any of Trump's silly season ideas. Because I think
it's hard to know what those ideas are beyond some vague thing you do on the border.
I don't know. Build a wall.
I want you to know that he was going to solve the Iranian question in one day.
Yeah, of course he was in
one day. Yeah. Anyway, let's change the subject. Yeah. Your brilliant, talented daughter, Tom, yes, takes after your wife. Your brilliant and talented daughter has just gone up to college. For a family, what was the trauma of that like? Getting the funding, getting the selecting.
Well, we're not quite there yet, Llewellyn. She's in a pre-college program, but Anna made the best of the situation. Because it was expensive, it was at Carnegie Mellon, and what she did was to, and she's in a music, she's learning how to compose music there, get some money from Moses Brown School, which was a wonderful award for her to do something interesting during the summer. It's called the Class of 48 Award. Right now, at this very moment, my wife and I and Anna are trying to decide how to negotiate the shoals of the whole financial thing. I completely agree with people who say that the system as it exists now with the private colleges is it's just going to get worse. And I think there's a huge wound up spring of a backlash ready to happen when people consider, and it's brought to the fore, the whole thing about student loans and the total cost of higher education. Is it worth it? The person I would mention is Mike Taibbi, who recently wrote a great article about it. And it's scary. And we don't know how we're going to deal with it, frankly.
Well, it seems we have these two things that we don't know how to deal with that are very emotional: education and the cost of education, and healthcare and the cost of healthcare.
I relate the two.
And they are in some way related because they're both net goods and they're expensive and people have differing opinions about how to solve them. I don't think there's so much of a political divide over education as there certainly is over healthcare. Well, how do you see this, Ed? Well,
the spending on education has gone insane. I mean, it's like, I have three kids. I put one through Mount Holyoke, and I'm going to be indentured for the rest of my life. But it's just amazing the amount of money that's gone into higher education in recent years. We've vastly increased the numbers of administrators. Mm-hmm. We're creating these palatial dining halls and rock climbing activities and gyms. And
bonuses for the administrators.
I was looking at some of the numbers. Between 1910 and 1978, the cost of education, college education, went up 1%. Each year when adjusted for inflation. Since 78, it's 3%. So that's, it's dramatically higher, just exploding. And there are different theories on this. One is that our federal loan programs have sort of distorted the whole marketplace, mm-hmm, and it's made it possible for these colleges to do this kind of stuff.
I think the thing that might help to resolve it is the fact that we have kids these days that are so facile with technology, that we will have to do something like have remote universities, mm-hmm, where they're not on campus, where they don't get that wonderful education where you're on campus and you're with your friends and where you're with your professors in your room, you're going to have to do it on site. It's going to be on your laptop, and it's going to be a lot less expensive. And it shouldn't have any less of a stature in degree as those who are able to afford to be on campus. So we might have two structures, maybe the kids that can afford to be there and have the whole wonderful experience of being with their teachers and colleagues, and the others who can't, but still get the same degree.
So in other words, it's another chasm between the people, the haves and the have-nots.
That's right.
You're going to see a huge movement. I'm hearing the beginnings of it now, of a political movement that higher education should be free.
There is a political movement about that. Well, there are huge discussions about free education.
But when fewer people went to college, we've vastly upped the numbers. There are many colleges. They're all trying to get more people. This is creating a college inflation, and the colleges themselves have found that they can charge more and more
And sometimes, if you're getting a degree in computer science, you could go to a technical school instead of Harvard University, say. Mm-hmm. We may have to do a lot of sorting that way. I think we need to give much more importance, much more
I don't think separate but equal is going to work, by the way.
No, I think it's unfair. And it's unfair for me to say
anybody who gets any instruction needs an instructor.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I just don't see the exceptional individual can do it all online, but that is the person who really is exceptional. The great majority of those who are underfunded need all of the things that come with the university. The peers, mm-hmm. the society, the lifting of horizons are not going to happen online.
Yeah.
If that worked online, everybody would watch PBS and wouldn't have to go to university.
Isn't everybody watching PBS?
I assure you they are not, and I fear
they're watching Trump.
Declining numbers. They're watching this people who spent 24/7 on Trump or opinions about Trump. We got rid of it in about 15 minutes. So there you are. What are the good things going on? Actually, we're running out of time here, so I think we should see the illustrations. Are you ready?
Oh no, not yet. No.
Well, I think
all
so.
Right. All right,
one
let's
minute
see.
Left.
I've just started drawing a ivory tower, and I was about to populate it.
I haven't populated it yet.
I was going to have a bunch of lunatics leaning out of the opening. So,
good idea.
So it's no fun.
Can we see that? Have we got a camera on that? There we are. There's the.
I'll populate it, and then you'll come back to it.
There you are. And let's see what else we have.
And given my rather negative view of what is happening in the Middle East and. I'm asking whether it's a mosque or a laboratory, a place of prayer or a place of enrichment. Take it either way. And this is the skyline of Tehran with the Israelis doing a little cleanup operation.
We're going to take these and put them, when you finish the other one, we'll put them on our website, whchronicle.com, and you can look at them on the website, and if you wanted to, probably even have the great artist prepare a special personal one for you at an enormous fee.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course.
Right.
And to help me with the higher education.
Right.
This is our show for today.